Better, she allowed. We've a job to do. We're going to do it. And if we do it right, ladies and gentlemen, we get to go home to our families. I have a gorgeous blonde who will be most ticked if I do it wrong. The chuckle in response was mostly honest, though there were a few awkward silences and gazes. Michelle waited. She knew what was going to come now. Do we know when the comms lockdown will be lifted? One of her pilots asked slowly. My wife, she's pregnant. Due any time now. Feels wrong that it could be days afterward before I know. Quigley, there are over 50,000 people in 41st Fleet, Michelle told him gently. Best guess is that there's at least a dozen spacers and officers in the same boat as you, and it sucks. But right now, that comms lockdown is protecting the lives of hundreds of thousands of your fellow spacers. It's protecting your lives, too. If Walking Stick learns our next target in advance, we will walk into one hell of a trap. I'll talk to the comms department, though, she promised. They'll keep an eye out for any messages from your wife for you. She looked around. That goes for all of you, she added. If there's something from home that's important, that you need to know about, let us know and we'll make sure it's fast-tracked through the lockdown. That does not, I'll note, include sports scores for your gambling, Michelle warned them. Like any privilege, abuse my goodwill and you'll find my help drying up fast. But for those of you with legit concerns back home, I'll help where I can. That help, Quigley? The young man, almost certainly a first-time father, which couldn't help with his nervousness, nodded, looking somewhat calmer. Now, since we seem to have talked out at least some of this, I think it's time for Admiral Roberts' solution, Michelle told them all with a returning grin as the two stewards returned, each pushing a cart with two full-size kegs of expensive beer.
Our people understand the mission, but I'd be lying if I said it wasn't impacting morale, Bayal said grimly, their tentacles fluttering around the captain's head as they poured tea for them.
It's affecting everyone's morale, Kyle told his captains. I was hoping that it would be offset a bit more by the fact that we're finally hitting back at the Commonwealth, but it probably says good things about our people that they don't like it.
Lord Captain Von Keita, the senior of Kyle's three Imperial captains, shook her head.
We could have found ships whose crews would have enjoyed it, she said grimly. Hessian's ships? Midori's ships? Others?
Kyle nodded. Enough systems had passed back and forth between the Alliance and Commonwealth over the course of two wars that it wouldn't be hard to find people with a grudge.
We intentionally didn't, he told Von Keita. The last thing we need is to start adding atrocities to our side of the ledger.
It's not like there's much galactic opinion left to screw with, Bayal noted. With us, the League and the Commonwealth fighting each other.
The tentacles laid down the tea as they shrugged.
That's what, 70-some% of the human race tied up in this war? And the rest is like Antioch or Istanbul. They barely matter.
Honestly? Kyle asked. At this point, we're more worried about opinion inside the Commonwealth. If we can appear more reasonable than their unificationists, we begin to win the moral battle. The moral is the physical as 3 is to 1, he quoted. If we can undermine the willingness of the Commonwealth's population to support the continued expansion of Terran hegemony, we win.
How do we do that? Novak asked.
We kick the Commonwealth Navy's ass repeatedly to demonstrate that they can't protect the Commonwealth from the consequences of the wars the Unificationists start.
There's a few irons in the fire to demonstrate that point as thoroughly as possible, Kyle said cheerfully.
Our job is to get and hold Walking Stick's attention. Sooner or later, that's going to get us hurt, he warned. But I look forward to seeing just what the good Marshal thinks is needed to take us down.
Chapter 20 Starkhaven System 1400, September 16th, 2737, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time Alliance 41st Fleet
Cube probes deploying. Senior Fleet Commander Zartosht Aurangzeb reported calmly in the moments after Elysium tore a hole back into reality. All ships have emerged on target, no drift.
Hold the fleet here, Kyle ordered. Let's see what Starkhaven holds for us, shall we?
Initial impressions were already coming in, but he waited to let Aurangzeb's staff go through them. What they could see from old light could be both informative and deceptive. Once the QCOM-enabled probes arrived closer in to the warships and planets, they could feed him more information.
So far, it's looking like intelligence was bang on the fixed defenses, at least, Kyle's operation officer told him. I've got 8 Zions orbiting Kirkwall and 4 over Ferelden. Nothing solid on warships yet. There's a few big energy signatures moving around. Could easily be tankers or...
Aurangzeb trailed off.
Zartosht? Kyle asked, linking into the tactical feed.
We have 2 assassins in Ferelden orbit as reported, and a trio of ocean-class strike cruisers in Kirkwall orbit.
Ah, Kyle replied, studying the data feed himself. The ships were separated, vulnerable. 41st Fleet had emerged closer to Kirkwall than to Ferelden, but he could still adjust his course to hit either group of defenders on their own. Of course, the starfighters from the other force would probably arrive while his people were busy mopping up the first one. He'd win. There was no question about that, really. But he could get hurt. He didn't want to lose people, and he couldn't spare the time to repair damaged ships. Studying the system layout, though, there were always options.
Hold all starfighters aboard, he ordered. Deploy ECM drones to make it look like we've got a strike formed up around us, and then follow this course.
He laid the course out in the tactical feed by feel as much as thought, relying on the AIs permanently assigned to assist the Admiral to adjust it to work best.
That course is asking for trouble, sir, Sterling said quietly.
Oh, I know, Kyle agreed cheerfully. And hopefully, the Commonwealth will be glad to deliver.
The Alliance ships couldn't see them, but it was a safe assumption that the defenders had layered the system with passively orbiting Q-probes to keep a careful eye on everything. The Commonwealth forces would have had real-time information on Kyle's fleet as soon as they'd arrived, where it would be an hour or more before his Q-probes were in position to give him the same. The course he'd set for the fleet looked hesitant, like he'd made a mistake coming out so close to Kirkwall and changed his mind. 10 capital ships and several hundred ECM drones pretending to be starfighters shaped their course toward Ferelden.
The orbital platforms have deployed their starfighters, and they're forming up around the assassins, Aurangzeb said. They're holding position for the moment, letting us come to them, designating them Force Alpha.
Logical, gives the Kirkwall Force, Bravo, I suppose, time to catch up with us, Kyle agreed.
What are they up to?
All of the starfighters are in space, forming up on the oceans, his ops officer told him. Looks like the Zions had pure wings of katanas, but the oceans were carrying half and half starfighters and bombers. 90 longbows, 490 katanas.
They're coming after us. Hard. All of them are burning at 500 Gs, leaving the starships behind.
Reasonable. Those starfighters, added to Force Alpha, are enough to give us a massive headache, Kyle concluded. Let them commit. Get our probes on both Bravo's fighters and Bravo's ships.
Aurangzeb shook his head.
They're going to figure you're trying something clever, sir, he pointed out. I'm sure they've been briefed as to who is leading this fleet.
Kyle grinned.
Oh, I know they think I'm trying something clever, he agreed. But they don't have a lot of choices. Neither Alpha nor Bravo stands a chance against us in isolation. But combined and backed up by the Zion's fighters, they can hurt us, if not stop us. So, let them think they have a chance, and see what they do with it.
Are we actually planning on launching starfighters at some point?
Vice Commodore Lakatos asked Kyle bluntly.
Or is this all some shiny game that you're enjoying too much for that?
Kyle smiled cheerfully at the man over the comm.
Please, Vice Commodore, allow me my fun, he told the starfighter pilot. You'll have yours before the day is done, but I'd like to make sure your people are all around to enjoy it.
I don't mind that, but I'm wondering how this is contributing to that, the junior man grumped.
Watch and learn, Kyle promised.
Watch and learn.
Minutes continued to tick away, and he watched Force Bravo's fighters commit to their pursuit of his fleet,
with Force Alpha continuing to maneuver to keep between him and Ferelden's orbital industry.
"I don't suppose anyone has hailed us," he asked.
"Everyone seems to be assuming this is only going to end in fire so far," Sterling told him. "Not a peep of radio, just starfighter launches."
He nodded, analyzing the vectors again. After an hour of accelerating after him, Force Bravo's fighters had traveled almost 2 light minutes and built up a velocity over 5% of light speed away from Kirkwall. With 41st Fleet accelerating away from them, they'd only closed the original 4 light minute range by 1 light minute, with a relative velocity of 3% of light. They'd closed to weapons range after he intercepted Force Alpha. For himself, he'd closed a full light minute towards Ferelden and would shortly cross the 2 light minute line where it would be no longer wise to enter Alcubierre Drive. He smiled.
"Let's give it another 10 minutes, he observed calmly. "Then pass this course to the fleet."
Sterling looked at the numbers he'd sent him, then stared at him levelly.
"Has anyone ever told you you're insane?" he asked.
"Yes," Kyle admitted. "Why? Don't you think our navigators are up to it?"
His chief of staff shook his head.
"They'll be up for it," Sterling replied grimly. "Because if any of them didn't start practicing this bullshit after they learned you were in command, they haven't been paying attention."
10 minutes later, Force Bravo's starfighters were a long way away from their motherships and base stations. The Ocean-class strike cruisers had been denied a role in the fight the moment 41st Fleet had turned away from Kirkwall and remained in the gas giant's orbit, sheepdogs above the cloud scoops and defense stations. Force Alpha was now accelerating out to meet the Alliance, their course clearly carefully calibrated to reduce the engagement time before Bravo's fighters arrived. It was all a very clever setup, making the best of the Commonwealth's limited resources and taking advantage of Kyle's swing from attacking Kirkwall to moving against the weaker force above Ferelden. What they'd missed, however, was that Kyle's swing had left his fleet moving through space where they could still bring up their Alcubierre Stetson drives. With less than 5 minutes to spare before they moved too close to Ferelden to do so, all 13 Alliance ships brought up their FTL drives and charged for Kirkwall. The logistics freighters swung wide, their course taking them well clear of the battle space, where they'd be safe while the warships secured the system. The warships went straight for the gas giant. For 2 minutes, they moved through space that was flat enough for AS drive, and then they hit Kirkwall's gravity. Threading the needle, it was called. Riding the thin line between a warp bubble collapsing and dropping the ship back into normal space unexpectedly, and the warp bubble shredding its contents. Few people were insane enough to do it with one ship, let alone 10. The very air in Elysium's flag bridge seemed to scream as 1,000 tiny gravity vortexes tore through the ship, and the massive warship jerked around her crew as she charged deep into the gas giant's gravity. The needle only lasted 2 minutes. It felt like 2 years, and then 41st Fleet erupted back into reality, the gravity warp dissolving as the Alliance warships emerged barely 1 million kilometers from the Ocean-class strike cruisers and the defense platforms. Genghis Khan and Righteous Sword had fallen off the needle, the battlecruiser and carrier emerging 12 million kilometers behind the rest of the fleet. It didn't matter. None of the carriers or cruisers mattered. What mattered was that Kyle's crazy trick had delivered Kronos and Gaia to well within the range of their massive, megaton-and-a-half-a-second positron lances. Even Magellan's 1.2-megaton lances were redundant. 10 seconds after 41st Fleet emerged from Alcubierre Stetson Drive, every Commonwealth warship and military installation in Kirkwall orbit was fire and debris.
"Bring us about," Kyle ordered grimly. "Get me a status on Force Alpha and Force Bravo's starfighters."
He smiled thinly. "And then get me a radio relay." The two Commonwealth forces were maneuvering to rendezvous, combining all of the starfighters into a single force with the assassins for fire support. With Kyle in control of Kirkwall orbital space, however, they now had to choose if they were going to come to him or let him continue to control the pace of the engagement. For now, however, it was time to talk. He leaned casually back in his chair and smiled at the pickup as they started recording.
"Commonwealth forces,
"This is Vice Admiral Kyle Roberts of the Alliance 41st Fleet," he told them. "I won't deny your courage, but I think enough people have already died here today. I am going to take the Starkhaven system," he continued. "I would prefer to do so with you as prisoners, but make no mistake, I will take this star system." "I am prepared to discuss the terms of your surrender," he said gently. "I think you will find I am prepared to be quite reasonable." He sent the message, then turned his attention back to the sensor feed, considering his next moves.
"Think they'll take you up on it?" Sterling asked.
"No," he admitted. "They're going to throw every one of those starfighters at us. The question," he tapped his fingers on the arm of his chair, "is the battle cruisers."
"The cruisers, sir?"
"If they're smart, they know this is a lost cause," Kyle explained. "Walking Stick himself might order them out of the system. It's not the most politically expedient decision, but it makes a lot of sense from a pure military perspective."
"Won't change much, will it?" his chief of staff asked.
"Not today," Kyle agreed. "Even if they take their starfighters with them, they can't take the Zion's birds or the oceans. That's still almost 800 starfighters and bombers they'd leave behind." 12 Zions between the two planets. 3 strike cruisers, 2 battle cruisers. The assassins could only carry 60 starfighters, and there were 840 Commonwealth fighters and bombers in the star system.
"So what do we do?"
"We take the system." "Do we have damage reports for Khan and Sword?"
"We do. Both erred on the side of dropping out rather than taking damage. They're a little fried around the edges, but otherwise fine. Kronos, on the other hand, rode it too hard," Sterling reported. "She'll be fine in the long run, but her Class 1 mass manipulators are badly misaligned."
"So she can fight, but she can't run," Kyle concluded. The Class 1s were the largest and most powerful of the mass manipulators that served 1,000 different functions aboard a starship. They were the only ones that could generate the miniature black holes necessary to establish an Alcubierre bubble. If Kronos's Class 1s were misaligned, she wouldn't be able to go FTL until they were fixed.
"Estimated repair time?" he asked.
24 hours, Sterling said instantly. "Can't do it while under fire, though."
"Of course not," Kyle allowed. "Fortunately for Captain Blue, I have no intention of leaving this system that quickly." "Aurangzeb," he turned to the ops officer. "Pass the order to the fleet. Formation Mu. Deploy all starfighters. No more games, people," he continued to his staff. "We head straight for Ferelden and see how much spine the Terrans have today." Chapter 21. Starkhaven System. 1700, September 16th, 2737, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Alliance 41st Fleet.
"Go, go, go!"
The words echoed in the cramped cockpit of Michelle's starfighter, moments before a moderately grumpy god sat on her chest. A Falcon's mass manipulators were rated to absorb 500 times the gravity of Earth. That was, however, with other mass manipulators dedicated to adjusting the mass of both the starfighter and its fuel. There was, as with everything else, an efficiency curve. With every mass manipulator set to counter acceleration, the ship could completely absorb 2,000 gravities and reduce the next 1,000 by 99%, and would consume every mass manipulator and erg of energy the spacecraft had. The mass manipulators in the walls of Elysium's launch tubes left absorbing inertia to the starfighters themselves. They spun up to reduce the mass of everything in the center zone by a factor of roughly 50,000. Then a series of massive electromagnets charged up, and the massive railgun surrounding Michelle fired. 10 gravities slammed Michelle Williams Alvarez and the rest of her crews into the back of their chairs, but the launch was over in fractions of a second, allowing her to breathe again.
"Form up, form up," she barked over the tactical net. "Clear the tube launch paths. Everyone else is coming out after us."
Every carrier in 41st Fleet had been built around a 60-second standard launch. In the space of 1 minute, the fleet went from 10 capital ships maneuvering to match velocities toward Ferelden on their own to having over 1,100 starfighters and bombers in space around them.
"Defensive formations," Lakatos ordered. "We stick with the fleet for now. Hold acceleration to match the capital ships."
Nothing truly stopped a capital ship from pulling the same acceleration as a starfighter. There were several plateaus, or tiers, in the efficiency curve of the mix between mass manipulators and antimatter engines. Starfighters rode Tier 3, around 500 gravities, where warships usually rode Tier 2, around 200 gravities. The difference in fuel efficiency was roughly 4 orders of magnitude. A starship could accelerate at Tier 3, but it cost them over 99% of their delta V. It was much cheaper for starfighters to do it, but it also saved fuel when the smaller ships kept pace with their parent vessels. "We'll see what the Terrans do next," Michelle murmured, studying the formation around her. The Alliance fighters would crush their Commonwealth equivalents. The numbers alone guaranteed that. But 800 katanas would take their toll of Alliance fighters along the way. 41st Fleet moved away from Kirkwall, leaving the wreckage of the first set of defenders they'd clashed with behind them as the Alliance force headed toward Ferelden. With the starfighters spreading out around them, their engines formed a glittering wall in space.
"Incoming transmission from the planet," Aurangzeb reported. "Looks like the governor."
"Hopefully this one is smarter than the last," Kyle said. "Play it." The woman who appeared on his screen was one of the tiniest adults he'd ever seen. She made it work, somehow, with an outfit that accentuated a clearly adult figure and a hairstyle that stacked her dark red hair up high enough to bring her to perhaps 150 centimeters tall.
"I am Miriam Shaywan," she introduced herself.
No title or rank, but Kyle's implant quickly confirmed that she was the governor of Ferelden in the middle of her third term.
"It is not within my mandate to order the surrender of the Commonwealth forces in this system," the tiny woman told them. "I am prepared to offer a compromise. We will not intervene with the evacuation or destruction of the military cloud scoops around Kirkwall, and you will withdraw with no further interference. If you approach this planet, however, the forces assembled around us will defend my people to their utmost. I can accept what I must, Admiral Roberts, but I also must do my duty."
The message ended, and Kyle sighed.
"Well, she's smarter than the last one," he admitted. "Possibly even more stubborn."
He shook his head. He could respect where she was coming from, but it didn't leave him a lot of choice.
"No response," he told Sterling. "Keep the fleet on course. How long until we engage the enemy?"
"A little over 2 hours to turnover," his chief of staff replied. "We'll enter Ferelden orbit in 4 hours, 7 minutes. Assuming they don't come out to meet us, we'll make torpedo range 35 minutes before that. Starfighter missile range 25 minutes afterwards. Heavy lance range somewhere in between."
"And when the starfighters come to meet us?" Kyle asked. Sterling shrugged.
"About 75 minutes earlier for all of those if they leave the starships behind."
"They'll leave them behind," Kyle concluded. "I bet you 100 stellars the cruisers are gone by then."
"That would make sense," Sterling agreed. "But when has the Commonwealth ever made decisions based on what makes sense?"
"When Walking Stick was in command, and this whole sector is under Walking Stick's authority."
"There go the cruisers," Michelle murmured, watching as the two assassins broke away from the cluster of starfighters.
"What are they doing?" Eklund asked, the gunner looking over the feed. "Looks like they're scooping up fighters as they go."
"They've been ordered to pull out," the Vice Commodore told him. "They know they can't hold, so someone with a brain is salvaging what they can."
She studied the sensor feed and shook her head.
"And they're not scooping up fighters, Lieutenant," she pointed out. "They're loading up the bombers. All of them. That's going to be cramped, but it looks like they packed all 120 bombers aboard."
That was telling. If nothing else, it meant that Walking Stick was being careful about expending his bombers. On the other hand, it still left 600-plus 7th-generation starfighters coming out to meet 41st Fleet. Michelle and her compatriots outnumbered that force almost 2-to-1, but the question wasn't if the Alliance was going to win. It was how badly they were going to get hurt, and 600 katanas could dish out a lot of hurt.
"Commodore Lakatos, do we pursue the cruisers?"
she asked the fleet cag. They could, after all, break free from the fleet and pursue the assassins. Negative, Admiral Roberts cut into the channel. I'm not trading starfighter crews we can't spare for a pair of obsolete battlecruisers. Hold formation. We'll take this slow and easy. Let them come to us and whittle them down as they do.
Any clever ideas, boss? Sterling asked,
the older officer watching as the Alliance fleet hurtled towards the defending starfighters. Nothing that isn't more likely to get a battleship killed than anything else, Kyle admitted. He could see three different ways to catch the cruisers and a few ways to surprise the fighter strike, but all of them were risky, and his opponents would be watching for something clever now. Order to the fleet. Target the Zions, he told Aurangzeb. Long-range missile fire. If we can take those out, it opens up options.
What kind of options?
His chief of staff asked as the missiles began to flare out. It would take most of an hour for the weapons to reach their targets, but they'd do so well before the real clash between the defenders and 41st Fleet began. I'm not sure yet, Kyle admitted. They had time right now, but their options were limited. A few hundred missiles wouldn't make that big a dent in his ammunition stockpiles, but would make certain the platforms in Ferelden orbit didn't contribute to the fight. Adjust our course, he ordered after a moment. Keep us outside the gravity well as long as possible. Let's see what they do. He smiled as a thought struck him. Force Bravo's fighters can't have that much fuel left, he noted, chasing us hither and fro across the star system. The bombers went aboard the cruisers, but everyone else is still running on their original fuel load. Let's see if we can make them dance. Minutes ticked away as 41st Fleet arced away from the planet, adjusting their orbit away from the enemy, forcing the starfighters to adjust their courses again, and again, and again. The missiles flashed past the defending starfighters at a long enough range that only a handful fell prey to the Commonwealth crew's attempts to defend their home base. Then,
somebody did the math, Aurangzeb announced. The Zions are abandoning. Escape pods and shuttles across the board. Can you tell if they're keeping a skeleton crew aboard or stripping them completely? Kyle asked. Not from this range. It won't matter, his ops officer continued. Skeleton crew will be dead in 20 minutes. They can't stop that salvo.
Is there anything else in orbit that can service starfighters? Kyle said. His staff pored over the scanner data for several minutes, making sure they had the right answer. They had the time, still.
A few things, Sterling finally told him. Nothing that can do so in bulk. Nothing that can rearm them. Just refuel and resupply life support, maybe 20 birds at a time across the entire orbital infrastructure.
So they're in last stand territory, Kyle said softly, watching as the assassins vanished into Alcubierre Drive on the other side of the planet. They can't win. They have no second chances. They've got one chance to hurt us as much as they can.
We could summon them to surrender, Sterling suggested.
No, Commander, they won't surrender, the Vice Admiral replied. We wouldn't, and sadly, I have faith in both their courage and their skill. He sighed. No, we've played this game out as far as we can. Everyone knows where we're at. If they were going to surrender, they would have. Take us in, gentlemen. Have the capital ship stand by for long-range lance engagement. He grimaced. We won't hit many of them with the big beams, but every one of them we take out early is one that isn't shooting at our people. No starfighter pilot was going to turn down going into battle with the big boys in formation, but Michelle had to admit it was a little bit disconcerting. The entire purpose of starfighters, after all, was to go out and mix it up because they were expendable, and capital ships weren't. And when you were firing antimatter warheads and directed positrons, it didn't take that much more firepower to kill a capital ship than a starfighter. Worse, capital ship weapons systems were designed to target other capital ships. The risk of being accidentally obliterated by your own side was significant.
Formation CD-5, everyone! Bombers forward! Lakatos ordered, earning an approving nod from Elysium's CAG.
Conical Donut 5 was exactly what the full name described, a cone of starfighters and bombers to help protect the starships with a hole at the tip for the capital ships to fire through. It started with capital ship missiles, the massive weapons larger than even the torpedoes the bombers carried. They blazed through the gap in the formation, charging down the gravity well toward the Commonwealth starfighters. Six salvos of full-sized jackhammer sevens passed through the gap in the fighter formation, over 1,000 missiles now leading the way. "Bombers, stand by!" Seconds turned to minutes, and the first Capital missile salvo struck home. The jackhammers were smarter and more capable than any other weapon in the arsenal, and priced to match, but charging into the teeth of over 600 starfighters was a worst-case scenario for them. 1,000 missiles killed perhaps 100 starfighters, but then the bombers launched, a second wave of 1,200 missiles sweeping toward the enemy. Those hit at the same time as the battleships and battlecruisers entered range. Their massive positron lances tore through space, lighting up the gap in the Alliance formation as they tore into the Commonwealth fighters. Dozens of starfighters died to the torpedoes. More died to the battleship beams as they cut into space. Then the rest of the Capital ships entered their own range, more and more beams of pure antimatter cutting through the void at the speed of light. And then, finally, the Terran fighters finally reached their own range. Over half of their number were gone, but 300 starfighters still salvoed over 1,000 missiles back into the Alliance's teeth. And the Alliance starfighters fired 6,000 in reply.
"Break formation! Maneuver independently!" Lakatos ordered. "Defensive patterns! They're gone, but they're going to launch twice more before they die! Don't join them!"
The starfighters scattered, pulling the incoming missiles after them as their neat conical formation disintegrated into a confusing swarm. Michelle rode that chaos, her mind linked intimately into her fighters' and her subordinates' computers. Random as the whirlwind her starfighters now moved in appeared, she and her people were in full control of it, creating a series of carefully calculated vectors and angles. No missile was going to come near any of her ships without running through the defenses of at least a dozen of them. The whirling dervish of death and survival cut across space, dodging around the incoming fire and hitting the missiles from 1,000 angles. 3 times, the Commonwealth missiles swarmed the Alliance formations. The first was the deadliest, with their motherships still intact to guide them in and provide computer support. The second and third salvos were on their own. Michelle breathed a sigh of relief as the last missiles died. None of Elysium's starfighters or bombers had been hit. As she let her attention expand, she could see that the rest of the fighter force hadn't been that lucky. It wasn't as bad as it could have been. 60, maybe 70 starfighters lost. Some of those crews would have ejected before the fighters died, and the logistics ships had the spares to fabricate new starfighters for them. Most of them were gone forever. Not even a tithe of 41st Fleet's fighter strength, but they had no replacement crews till they went home, and that wouldn't be until the mission was done. The Commonwealth starfighters hadn't been nearly as lucky. There was a reason the Alliance hadn't launched a second salvo. After the torpedoes, the starship missiles and the heavy beams, only 300 fighters had remained to face the 6,000 missiles that had come at them.
"Well done, people," Admiral Roberts' familiar voice echoed over her implants. "Now do me proud and make sure we flag every survival pod the Commonwealth launched. The fight's over. Let's make sure no one dies who doesn't have to."
Kyle studied the sensor feed for several long seconds. Every threat in Starkhaven had been neutralized. 3 capital ships and 12 defensive platforms destroyed, along with over 600 starfighters. 2 more capital ships driven from the system, with 100 bombers aboard. No capital ship losses, not even a scratch on any of his starships. Enough starfighter losses to be painful, but not enough to materially impede the fleet's combat strength. Search and rescue shuttles were already swarming the debris from the battle space, and Magellan was on her way back to Kirkwall to pick up the SNR shuttles they'd left there. Magellan would also bear the responsibility of finishing the job of destroying Kirkwall's infrastructure. He sighed.
"Do we have a comm channel with Governor Shay Wan?" he asked.
"We have a frequency and a receiver, yes," Sterling told him.
"Get a Q-probe in place for a real-time conversation," Kyle ordered. "Let me know once it's done."
"We already have one in Ferelden orbit,"
Aurangzeb replied. Give me 60 seconds and I'll have it lined up. The Vice Admiral waited patiently until his operations officer gave him a thumbs up and then opened the channel.
Governor Shay Wan, this is Admiral Roberts. Please respond.
It only took a few seconds for the tiny woman to appear on his screen. She looked exhausted, her complex, piled hairstyle fraying around the edges. She'd almost certainly been running since his arrival in the system 12 hours ago.
Admiral, she said flatly, I allow myself no illusions. We are beaten. What do you want?
He raised a hand.
I have neither the soldiers nor the desire to invade or occupy your worlds, he told her. Nor do I intend to permit Marshal Walking Stick to catch me, Governor Shay Wan. I also have no desire to inflict any casualties beyond what is absolutely necessary. My objective here is the destruction of your system's orbital industry. You have 48 hours to evacuate all of your civilians to designated residential platforms.
He gave her an intentionally flat smile.
Understand that we will validate your designation of platforms as residential, he noted. My intentions are to carry out this destruction as cleanly as possible, but I will not be manipulated or deceived. Do we understand each other?
Shay Wan bowed her head in silence.
Governor?
He asked softly.
I understand, she finally allowed. You're talking decades of work. Millions of people's livelihoods. How can you be so damned casual?
Because I was at Kamadian, Governor, he told her, where a Terran officer bombarded a world. Because I was at Hessian, where the spaceborne industry was destroyed with the workers aboard. Because my nation, Governor Shay Wan, did not choose this war.
There are consequences for what the Commonwealth has chosen to unleash. My own honor requires they be administered cleanly. But I will see the Commonwealth punished for bringing war to my worlds regardless.
The evacuations will be carried out as you order, she finally said stiffly. I do not know if there are any purely residential platforms in Kirkwall orbit at all, though.
Then you will evacuate to the least industrialized platforms, Kyle noted. We will be as reasonable as we can, Governor, but our duty remains.
Fuck your duty, she snapped. We will do as we must.
As will we all, he told her. As will we all.
Chapter 22 Niagara System. 0800, September 19th, 2737, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. BB-285, St. Michael. Fleet Admiral James Calvin Walkingstick, Marshal of the Rimward Marches, chosen champion of the Terran Commonwealth, commander of over 100 starships, and, by any of a dozen measures, among the most powerful human beings alive, stared at the shattered plant pot resting against the wall of his office. The little plant had been a gift from his staff, a small piece of life from his homeland on Earth to brighten up his working space. It had also been the only thing to hand when the final reports from Starkhaven had come in. He'd liked the potted fern, a memory of a continent he hadn't set foot on in 20 years. But everything else in his office was virtual or built in. Nothing else had been easily grabbed. Another star system's industry destroyed. 3 capital ships lost, and the only reason it hadn't been 5 was because he'd directly ordered Commodore Freeman to withdraw. The man had been perfectly willing to die standing in Starkhaven's defense.
Sir?
Andrea Messera's voice pierced his thoughts. His secretary was standing at the entrance to his office.
Are you all right?
I'm fine. James said slowly. Just a lovely cascade of bad news. Any updates?
Roberts and his fleet just entered Alcubierre Stetson Drive, she told him. Starkhaven is no longer occupied, but our closest force is still 4 days away.
And they still need to go play relief.
James crossed over to the plant, kneeling down to try and pull together enough dirt around the fern's roots to keep it alive.
Can you get me a new pot, Andrea? I'd like to save the plant if I can.
She didn't say anything aloud, but he saw her nod in the mirror.
Where's Freeman? He asked.
5 days from here, she confirmed. He'll arrive on the 24th.
We'll assign him to Vasek when he gets here, James concluded aloud. Set up a conference with him and my tactical team. Include me. We need to try and get a handle on what Roberts is doing. Vasek's fleet isn't helping anyone, arriving a week late every time. We need to get ahead of the ball with this bastard.
Of course, sir. I'll set it up.
Messera paused, and James finally turned to look directly at his attractive blonde aide. He sighed.
Drop the damn shoe, Andrea, he ordered. What is it?
Senator Burns has requested a QCOM call as soon as possible, she told him. He didn't sound happy.
James sighed again and nodded. Senator Michael Burns headed the Committee on Unification. More than any other person, he was responsible for James Walkingstick holding his current command, which made him the closest thing James had to an actual boss.
Help me clean this up, he said, gesturing at the plant. Then connect him through.
Senator Michael Burns was a heavy-set black man with pure white hair, the elected representative of the Alpha Centauri system. His holographic image paced across the floor of James's office, just as Burns was pacing across his actual office in Seoul.
James, please tell me you have a plan,
he said without much in terms of preamble. James chuckled.
Hello, old friend, he said dryly. How are your wives and kids?
Burns snorted.
Hope is good.
None of my ex-wives have spoken to me in 3 years, all of which you damn well know,
the senator pointed out.
The kids are busily turning Daddy's millions into their own billions. I see them at Christmas.
Most years.
If you want pleasantries, we can do them. But damn it, James, what is this mess?
Burns demanded. The marshal shook his head silently. It wasn't like he had a wife or kids of his own. The Commonwealth was his life, just as it was for Burns, and the Navy had never left him time for even the senator's failed marriages.
This mess, as you so eloquently put it, was the inevitable consequence of my not having enough ships to end this damn war a year ago,
he said quietly.
Sooner or later, the Alliance was going to launch a real offensive into our own space. I'm honestly surprised it took them this long. Their insistence on closing ranks and liberating worlds we took away from them has worked thoroughly in our favor to this point.
He shrugged.
They're being damned careful about it, too, he pointed out. Hitting systems they know are weak with overwhelming force. I don't think they knew Rear Admiral Ngo was in Starkhaven, so they were expecting to face 2 capital ships with 10. Admiral Ngo's task force certainly didn't change anything,
Burns snapped.
No. Because Roberts was in command, and while he's no demon, he is certainly a superior tactician,
James concluded.
I'd give my right arm to have that man under my command, Senator. I've admirals who are his peers, but none who are his equals.
The marshal smiled thinly.
Except myself, of course, he admitted. That flair for the dramatic and sense of when to go for the jugular reminds me of my own early commands.
I don't care if he reminds you of yourself, the senator told him.
I care about how you plan on stopping him. Carefully, James replied. He has too powerful a force under his command for me to disperse my fleets in penny packets across every potential target. I have assembled a strike force under Admiral Vasek, but they need to know where he's going, and I don't know that. If you want to light a fire under intelligence, that would make my life a lot easier, he concluded.
I'll do what I can, Burns promised. But that's no guarantee, you know that.
Not if they've got half a clue on OPSEC, and I'm hearing rumblings out of the intelligence community that a lot of their networks are getting rolled up right now. The Da Vinci operation seems to have set them to running.
James smiled grimly.
Let them run. Michelangelo and Raphael are next up. Tasca and Gabor are ready.
He shook his head.
Leonardo will depend on how bad their losses are, but if all goes well, the Renaissance trade factor will be out of the war in a month.
Be careful, James, Burns advised. I don't want to interfere in your operations, but if Roberts keeps smashing systems with senatorial representation, the Senate does have the authority to give you orders.
Keep the damned politicians off my back, Michael, James replied fiercely. The Senate has cut my feet out from underneath me too many times already. All you ever needed to do was give me enough ships and get out of my way.
I am one of 15 on the committee, Burns reminded him. One of over 100 in the Senate and over 1,000 in the Star Chamber. I trust you, Admiral. I respect your skills. But when the skies above our worlds burn, the Senate must look to protecting our citizens first.
Without some kind of evidence, we need more than 2 data points to know where to send your fleet, sir.
Commander Seamus Bowsade was a slim, dark-skinned man with flaming red hair tied back in a neat ponytail. He was the most junior man in the call, but the analyst faced Admiral Vasek levelly as he spoke.
The Starkhaven system is one of Niagara's key supply points, but Oswiri is, well, frankly, militarily and industrially valueless,
Bowsade continued.
And if Roberts knows our key supply points, he traveled right past the Calibri system to get to Starkhaven. And Calibri is equally important to our logistics situation.
So you're saying we need to let this son of a bitch burn out another Commonwealth system before we can intercept him?
Vasek asked. The newly breveted Vice Admiral sounded grouchy. James couldn't blame her. Taking down the Stellar Fox would guarantee that she'd get to keep the extra star. But every system Roberts raided was a massive black mark on every officer in the Rimward Marches.
That's not what Commander Bowsade is saying, Commodore Anjali Korna said flatly.
The dark-haired Indian woman who led James's tactical analysis team leapt bravely to her subordinate's defense.
He's warning you that we have no guarantees. Any target we give you is little more than a guess.
That said, we've done some guessing, she concluded dryly. If you're interested, sirs?
Lay it out, Anjali, Seamus, James ordered.
An astrographic chart appeared in the holographic conference, showing the entire sphere of Terran Commonwealth space.
In theory, there's nothing stopping Roberts from driving even deeper into the Commonwealth,
Bowsade noted.
Restricting that are 2 things, time and his actual objectives. Our assessment is that his objective is to cause political chaos and pressure for us to divert from our offensives, he continued. That means he won't go for any deep strikes, but will almost certainly focus his operations in the area of the Commonwealth that's considered part of the Rimward Marches, and hence our area of responsibility.
The chart zoomed in, focusing in on the border between the Commonwealth and the Alliance.
Depending on how we draw that line, it includes between 12 and 19 star systems, including Niagara and Via Samnia,
Bowsade noted.
6 of those star systems are key to keeping the Niagara fleet base supplied and operational. While we've tried to keep which systems are important for that under wraps, it's unlikely that Alliance intelligence isn't aware of them. That tells me that Roberts is hitting other systems to make us think that he doesn't know, but almost certainly does.
That would fit, James agreed. It's what I would do.
Korna shook her head.
My staff and I guess, she stressed the word, that Roberts is only going to hit our key systems every 2 or 3 attacks. That means we can eliminate 5 systems from our potential targets.
Those 5 systems flashed green, leaving only 12 potential targets.
The main question left is whether he's going to make another longer distance gap between systems or hit something close to Starkhaven, she noted.
I think he's going to make a short jump, probably hitting Presley or Vigil.
Those 2 systems, the closest to Starkhaven at 4 and 7 light-years away, flashed red.
I and several of the other analysts think that he's going to make another long jump,
Bowsade told the conference.
He's being clever, but he doesn't want to risk being too clever.
and making a 10 or more light-year jump gives him a lot of options to keep us guessing. He hasn't taken any significant losses, but I think his next attack will move him closer to Alliance space, allowing him to return home and rearm and replace starfighters, the analyst concluded. James put a mental checkmark next to the younger man. Not many officers would offer an alternative analysis to their superior in front of the marshal of their operating area, and the fact that Corna had clearly encouraged it was a good sign for her as well.
"Would you like to hang odds on particular targets, Commodore, Commander?" he asked.
The two exchanged a glance, then Corna gestured towards her junior.
55-45 on a short jump versus a long one," Bausade said levelly. "All told, I'd say 30% chance Presley, 20% Vigil, 5% another close-in system. For a long jump, 15% each for the Carnelian or Jinsei no Ai systems, 15% for another system we haven't considered."
James considered, then shook his head.
"Vasek, you can't get to Presley in time," he noted. "If they're going to Carnelian or Jinsei no Ai, that puts them close to Viasomnia, and they could easily slip another task force off of Seventh Fleet to mousetrap you."
"You're thinking Vigil, then?"
the Vice Admiral asked.
"All of this is guesswork and random estimations," Corna warned. "Vigil makes the most sense if we can't make Presley, but the odds of intercepting Roberts still suck."
"They do," James agreed. "But we'll take them anyway. I want you on your way to Vigil as soon as possible, Admiral. How long?"
Vasek laughed.
"About 5 minutes after I get out of this conference," the Admiral said dryly. "We pulled everyone aboard and started prepping to go as soon as we heard Roberts had taken Starkhaven."
Chapter 23. Deep Space in the Terran Commonwealth. 1800, September 20th, 2737, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. DSC-062 Normandy. In many ways, Russell was surprised that it took a whole week for the first fight to break out in the Space Force mess. A week wasn't an unusual amount of time to spend in FTL, though usually you knew that it wasn't going to be much longer after that. With another 20 days before Seventh Fleet was going to arrive, the pressure of the isolation and inability to leave the ship was beginning to wear down on the fighter crews. The ship crew itself was busy with the 1,001 tasks necessary to keep even a warship under Alcubierre Stetson Drive safe and functioning. The starfighter crews had much less to keep them occupied. There were only so many times a day you could double-check the same systems to make sure that nothing had somehow crept into them while they were shut down. Exercises and training could only take up so much time as well, which left Russell's people with too much time to get into trouble. He wasn't sure who had started the fight, but by the time he made it into the main mess hall, it had already spread. There were no coherent sides, no alliances, just a group of physically fit men and women taking their cabin-fevered frustrations out on each other.
"Seal the doors," he ordered,
watching security barriers slam down in response. Now, at least, the trouble was going to be contained. He stalked into the middle of the chaos. Someone, not paying enough attention, spun out of their most recent fight and took a swing at Russell. The Vice Commodore caught the fist in his own massive hand and slammed the offending officer to the ground. He probably should have noted who it was, but he understood the nature of what was going on there. He leapt on top of one of the still-standing tables and looked down on the chaos, shaking his head.
"Paten hut!"
he bellowed, training and muscle allowing his voice to hammer through the noise. Starfighter crew weren't the best disciplined military personnel, but they'd gone through boot camp like everyone else in the Federation Armed Forces. About half of his people tried to snap to attention. The other half kept punching, which left about a third of the officers in the room still standing, looking abashedly up at where Russell was standing above them.
"You bunch of idiots," Russell said conversationally. "Do any of you even know what started this?"
An ashamed silence answered him.
"Right. Apparently, we need to up the tempo of the exercises to make sure you all don't have enough energy to cause this kind of bullshit," he continued. "You are soldiers of the Federation. What's your excuse?"
His people remained silent, and he shook his head.
"The stewards are not cleaning up this mess," he told them. "Chief Lamond!"
The head steward for the mess, a Navy chief petty officer, materialized next to the table Russell was standing on.
"Sir?"
he asked politely.
"I'm turning control of the security system over to you," Russell explained. "None of these fine officers of the Castle Federation Space Force leave until the mess hall is clean to your satisfaction."
He smiled. "Whether or not you want to give them any tools for that cleaning is entirely up to you." Later, in Captain Herrera's breakout room, Russell found it significantly harder to find the humor in the situation.
"My people are feeling it the worst," he noted to Herrera and the XO, Melanie Craven. "But everybody aboard is starting to get itchy. Long flights are hell on morale."
"We haven't even accelerated up to our maximum pseudo-velocity yet," Craven pointed out. "That's 10 days, she shook her head. "And another 10 to slow down at the other end. We only spend 6 days at full speed, though that's a terrifying realization."
"I don't remember the last time I was aboard a ship that even reached 10 light-years a day," Captain Herrera admitted. "I'm not sure I ever have been."
"I have," Russell admitted. That mission was classified still, but he wondered if the super-long jump involved in Chameleon's raid on Tau Ceti had been practiced for this.
"There's nothing worse about it. Hell, there's nothing about any FTL velocity that really bothers us. It's just the isolation. Khan's lockdown means all we get is recorded messages. No live chats with friends and family. Nothing." Russell shook his head. "It's hard on the crew," he noted. "Add being locked inside an invulnerable bubble offset from reality? My little brawl isn't going to be the last issue we have. And, well, there is only so much work we can have our people do."
"You underestimate my imagination," Craven said dryly. "A tool I suspect I may not have given enough rein just yet."
"We have 20 more days, Russell replied, "after which we take our crew into battle against the most fortified star system in human space. We can't let them spend that time getting into fights and trouble." "We also can't take them into that battle exhausted," Herrera said. "We need them rested and ready for the fight of their lives."
"They won't be that if we let them cause chaos for 3 weeks, Craven said. "I think we need to link up with the other ships, build some fleet-wide exercises, work everyone like dogs until, D-Day minus 2?
"And then give them 2 days to relax after we've worn them down?" the captain asked.
He nodded thoughtfully.
"We'll want to touch base with the Admiral, but you're right. That's probably our best shot."
Russell shook his head.
"It's all we've got," he agreed. "So we'll make it work. But I think we also need to make sure our people understand the stakes. I've read the full brief, but we need to tell our people more of what they're getting into. They need to know this one is for all the marbles." "We're not cleared to share that much information," Herrera objected. "So talk to the Admiral," Russell suggested, "and get us cleared. Our people have been strapped into giant steel coffins for a week, with 3 more weeks ahead of them, and then one great mothering battle. They need to know why. We need to tell them enough that they know that the entire fate of the Alliance is riding on how this mission goes. If they don't know that, we're just going to have more trouble."
"If they do know that, I think we'll have them behind us all the way."
Herrera sighed.
"I'll talk to Admiral Rothenberg," he promised. "I doubt you're the only one thinking that way, Cag. We're asking people to do a hell of a thing, especially the Trade Factor crews with family in Da Vinci. You're right. They have to know what they're part of."
Chapter 24. Presley System. 0500, September 23rd, 2737, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Alliance 41st Fleet.
"Welcome to the Presley System," Sterling intoned as the starships flashed back into reality. "Home to the planet Ambrose, known for its tropical paradise of constant rain and wind, complete lack of holiday appeal, tidal power, and fish."
You visited, I take it? Kyle said dryly as his implant feeds updated him on the star system. Ambrose was a very wet world, over 90% water, with a scattering of large island chains that supported 250 million or so humans.